September, October, November. Have a time you'll always remember. At beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Make your fall fabulous at Mount Airy Lodge or Pocono Gardens. Do all the things you've wanted to do all summer, all day, all night. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 966-7210 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Hello and welcome to FW Presents, the anthology show for the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this is another episode of Mountain Comics, the show where I look back at the comic books I bought while on vacation in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania in the 1970s and 1980s. And joining me in the cabin this month is my pal, Tom Panarese. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how's it going?
It's great. I'm happy to have you here. This is your first appearance on Mountain Comics, even though it took us all the way to season four. I'm glad you're finally here. Before we get to the comic book in question, which is New Teen Titans number 25, I need to ask you, do you have anything like this? Do you have vacation comics? Do you have something like this in your background?
I do. It's kind of funny. So you vacationed in the Poconos, and my parents since 1987 – have been renting this cabin for about a week or two every year up in the lakes region of New Hampshire, outside in a small lake called Keyser Lake. It's in like North Sutton, New Hampshire, which is not too far from Lake Sunapee. And I went up there from the time I was about 10 to, it looked like it was about 16. And then after that, I was just kind of like either I was in college or whatever, and then I, you know, moved out. So, but they've been going up there for more than 30 years. And
wow.
The years I was up there, they have there's like a general store right on the lake. And then there, the town of New London, which is like the next town over, has a lot more to it. And, we used to buy a lot of baseball cards, but it wasn't so much comics as it was Mad and Cracked magazines that I remember.
Beloved Cracked magazine.
Yeah, just we would buy. I remember the first Mad magazine I remember buying was it was 1989 because it was the one that parodied the Batman movie.
Oh, right, sure.
It has Alfred E. Newman on the cover wearing the bat suit, but the Superman symbol is on the bat suit.
And I remember that one. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was my first Mad. And then we would buy Cracked. And then like they would always have like the drugstores up there would always have like not just like that month's issue of Mad, maybe the previous months, but always like the super specials that were basically like, you know, reprints of things. So we had like – I had like a stack of those things for like 3 or 4 years before. But no specific comic books. I do remember that we would – you know, my parents would drag us to different towns and places to do shopping sometimes. And every once in a while we would be able to pop into a bookstore. And I remember getting a couple of trade paperbacks. So this is the early 90s, so they were – you know, the pickings were slim when it came to trade paperbacks. So I remember two. I specifically remember one was the Catwoman. It was that mini series that was in the late 80s. My Sister's Keeper, I think, is the name of the trade. And then because I know Shag says that everybody goes through a Batman phase.
He says a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I know. I think everybody actually goes through an X-Men phase at one point or another too. And my X-Men phase kind of coincided with the rise of Image, so it was like the end of the Jim Lee era and whatever. So I remember specifically buying the trade Cable and the New Mutants, which was all the Rob Liefeld New Mutants issues, a bunch of them. Yeah, and that was me chasing trends because I had friends who were reading all that stuff, and they were like, "Oh, this is so cool!" So I felt like I had to read it. You know.
So this cabin that your parents mm-hmm. went to, like, was there like a TV? I mean, was it like, because like me with the mountains, there was no TV, so I had nothing kind of to do but read. So were you reading more than you normally would?
Oh yeah, yeah. Because there was no, it was like, I think they were like old summer camp cabins, and there was no television. We had a radio, so we would find the one station, the one or two stations you could get all the way out there that played something that was, you know, like palatable for our. You know, or we played just lots of cassettes. yeah, I read, I would read, I would blow through like 3 or 4 books over the course of a week. You know, in addition to the swimming and, you know, the outdoorsy things and many, many, many games of Uno, lots of Uno, but yeah, it's just, it was fun. I think the last couple of years of it, I remember being really, really bored because, we would go up there with family friends and the kid, and it was me, my sister's 3 years younger than I am. And then the family friends had kids who were closer to her age. So when I'm 16 and they're like 13, 12, 14, you know, that age difference, you know.
Oh, that's a Grand Canyon of
age. Yeah, yeah. So the last year or so I was just like terminally bored. And then, this is like talk about like bougie things. I did one of those like student ambassador trips to Europe when I was 17, like, you wow. know, those big groups. Yeah. So I did that. And then I think, I don't know how the hell I got away with staying at home for 2 weeks when I was 18, the summer between senior year and college, because the summers of college, I had the excuse of, I can't go on vacation with you. I have to work because mm-hmm. I had a summer job. But that summer, I'm like, I don't know how the hell I got away with not going up there when I was 18, especially considering, like, you know, I had a girlfriend at the time, you know, and I was home alone. So yeah, but no, yeah, it's listening to the show brings me back to reading all of those, like rereading and rereading all those Mad magazines. And then I do remember one of the kids, like for the first couple of years, he was still reading G.I. Joe. And I had stopped reading G.I. Joe maybe a year or two before. So he had a bunch of them, and I remember borrowing them and like reading some of them. So still, you know, like random things like that as well.
That's interesting that Mad and Cracked, I guess because they were provided as magazines, probably along with the other magazines, that mm-hmm. these newsstands got them as opposed to comic books, which were shipped presumably by a different distributor and just a different yeah. way because it was a completely different – I mean – most people that read comics don't make that distinction between yeah. Mad and comic books, but yet I guess probably to a newspaper, a newsstand dealer, there's a world of difference because they're just yeah. two different products. So that's funny that Mad and Cracked made its way up that far.
Yeah, and it's funny that I never decided to just – because they had comic books up there, and I do remember one summer – right around the time I had actually started collecting for real, because I started collecting for real about like 1990. And I remember getting a copy of an old, like a Batman comic that had been out for a couple of, like for a while, that I didn't have, mainly because this particular drugstore just kept stuff on the shelf like that. Like, you know, because I guess the comic books were not just like they weren't a constant stream of something that was coming in. But, you know, other than that, yeah, I don't remember for some reason actively seeking them out. I must have just been very satisfied with the fact that I would go back to my LCS and my books would be waiting for me, especially as it got later on. Because my local comic shop was not very far from my house. It was one of the few places that I could – go even as a little kid, like as 9, 10 years old, on my bike, because it was, you know, it was like right up by the Little League field and the library, and then I think the other two places were like the video store and the pizza place. I mean, it was just, I lived in a small town, and there was a certain border where my parents didn't want us to go like past, and the comic shop was well within that. So I think I was just like, yeah, I'll just be able to get it at the comic store when it comes out in a week or two. So,
you know, a comic store and a pizza place, like what more do you need? You
know, yeah, I know.
I'm done. I'm good. Yeah. That's good. I don't need anything more than else. Well, that's really cool. I'm glad to mm-hmm. glad to know you have that memory. I love hearing about that from different people, their own versions of Mountain Comics. So that's that's really cool. So, like I said, I'm excited to have you here. This is your first appearance on the show. So we said we're here to talk about New Teen Titans number 25. It came out August 12th, 1982. The story is called War! Exclamation mark by Marv Wolfman and George
what
Perez.
What is it good for?
Exactly. Of course, it's Wolfman and Perez, and inked by Romeo Tangal. So the story is Starfire has been kidnapped by her sister Blackfire and brought back to their homeworld of Tamaran. The New Teen Titans headed into deep space to rescue Starfire, but found themselves in the middle of a civil war on the planet Okara, fighting alongside the greatest heroes ever assembled, the Omega Men. This war was started by the I didn't think I was going to be able to get that one by. This war was started by the rulers of the Vegan star system known as the Citadel, who have claimed the all-powerful vegan goddess Exhal as their own. Above Okara, a Citadel warship prepares to dock, but inside, the Teen Titan known as Changeling has stowed aboard, assuming the form of an alien being called a Gordinian. He buys enough time for Robin and Cyborg, unconscious from a previous battle, to wake up and get the drop on an armed guard. Down on Okara, Raven falls victim to her empathic powers as she is overwhelmed by all the pain and misery she perceives and the battles raging around her. Exile, having seen enough destruction, calls off the Omega Men and, consequently, the other Titans, saying she will head to the Citadel. Also headed there are Robin, Cyborg, and Changeling aboard the stolen warship. The kidnapped guards, as he doesn't want to die in this war either, so he promises he will help get the Titans in. But then, just at the last moment, he double-crosses them and tells his fellow guards to capture the Titans. They manage to knock out the guards and then split up and search for Starfire. Deep inside the Citadel, Starfire is being tortured by her sister and a Scion scientist. Suddenly, the Omega Man known as Demonia appears and offers to double-cross her teammates and work for Blackfire. Robin, who is very, very tense, Cyborg and Changeling make it into the Citadel throne room where Exhal is floating, seemingly unconscious. A guard comes in and dumps Starfire's body onto the floor. Robin, thinking she is dead, goes into a rage and attacks. Cyborg gets the drop on the leader and says he will kill him if Blackfire doesn't surrender. Her response is to kill Damon, assuming the role of ruler. Robin then suggests Blackfire lets them leave since she has gotten what she wanted, to rule. Blackfire counters by saying she will now destroy Tamaran and make Starfire watch. Starfire flies into a rage and says she will stop Blackfire even if she dies in the attempt. To be continued. All right, so Tom, what was your history with New Teen Titans? Did you buy this comic regularly well, I guess not as a kid. You would have been very young. But, I mean, what's your history with this book?
I started collecting this via back issues. I started reading the New Titans, so what would have been – originally was called the Baxter series, as we tend to refer to it under New Teen Titans. But I started with 71. So my first issue of New Titans that I bought was the first issue of the Titans Hunt storyline.
Okay.
So that was a real jumping on point. I had read a couple of issues because a friend had loaned me the Lonely Place of Dying crossover, the Tim Drake the first appearances of Tim Drake, et cetera, et cetera. But my introduction to the Titans was the Titans Hunt. And then what was very cool about this was that back in 1991, the Wolfman, with the exception of like certain very, very key issues, the Wolfman Perez Titans were not hard to come by in back issue bins at an affordable price. So I was paying like $1.50, $2 a back issue, you know, which at a comic shop that didn't really have 50-cent bins was pretty good, considering like, you know, Claremont X-Men issues were going for $4 or $5 a piece.
Yeah,
they were
pricey, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, the really pricey ones were like, you know, the number ones, the number two, which was the first appearance of Deathstroke. I paid a lot of money through Mile High Comics for that. the first appearance of Nightwing, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So like, you know, the ones that were like, you know, really, really important. But, you know, this one, I actually got this one I was visiting my friend in Florida, and the two of us were big comics fans. Now, he was the one who got me into the X-Men, and he was the one who also bought me Spawn number one. but we went to his LCS, and they had like – and I had like a ton of money with me and like spending money. And I dropped a decent amount of money at that comic shop, and they had all of these – the Titans issues from like around this time that my LCS didn't have. So I paid a couple of bucks for this, but – but yeah, so I bought this whole thing in back issues. The only issues I'm missing of this series are like deep into the reprint run, mm-hmm. Tales of the Teen Titans, like some of the last few issues of the reprint run. But otherwise, I have this whole thing from DC Comics Presents 26 all the way up to the end of the Baxter series, and actually, I think all the way up to the end of the Geoff Johns, the Teen Titans that started with the Geoff Johns run. So.
I certainly bought this comic at the time. I was excited by it. I mean, it was a huge mm-hmm. hit for people too young to remember. It really, in some ways, marked the turning point for DC in a lot of ways, because it was really one of the few. Marvel had really had a lot of exciting things going on with a lot of new talent, and then all of a sudden, boom, DC had this new Teen Titans with Wolfman and Perez, and they really refurbished this brand, this Teen Titans brand, which had kind of languished for a while, and really they brought yeah, I mean, not that DC didn't do these things, but they really kind of brought a sort of Marvel sort of melodrama to these characters that had never been seen before. And it was a nice, of course, a mix of the older characters and the newer characters. And I will say, I didn't always get this comic. I mean, despite my reputation, I didn't have a ton of money to spend all the time. So, I mean, Teen Titans was a book that I would get as like a second tier book. Like, it was, you know, it was like Justice League, Brave and the Bold. Those were like first tier, Star Wars. And then like second tier would be like, well, if I have extra money, then I would get Detective Comics or New Teen Titans. So I don't have every New Teen Titans, or I didn't have them at the time. So this, I would kind of bop in and out of New Teen Titans. And in fact, I covered an issue of New Teen Titans on a previous episode of Mountain Comics, number 13, which was directly, exactly a year before this one. I will say one of the things that made me kind of gray out a little New Teen Titans was when they did these stories, when they went into space and they did all this stuff with Starfire. This was the even though I love the Omega Men, and I know people think I'm crazy, and I love the Omega Men, but like all this stuff in, like, to me, the New Teen Titans just don't fit in space. Like, to me, I'm like, they just don't. That's the Justice League. The Teen Titans are Earth characters, not I don't know. And rereading this comic, while I enjoyed it, I always am just like, all these aliens running around. It doesn't fit to me.
So there's like a 2-year period of the New Teen Titans that starts right after this issue. That is like my favorite stretch of that particular book, where it starts with the Runaways storyline. It ends with, like through the Judas contract, and then like up until like, you know, kind of where the Baxter series starts, like, right. I guess with Donna Troy's wedding and some of the stuff after that. And a lot of it is more street level. I mean, there's Brother Blood in there. There's the Hive. There's the Hive and there's Deathstroke. It's all earthbound and stuff. I'm kind of with you, because I had for years, I only had for a while, not for years, I mean, for about a year or so, I only had the annual that completes this story.
Right. And that's the other part, is that this is part of a multi-part story. And I don't think I ever got the annual, so I never really saw how this paid off.
It's part three, I believe, of let me see. I think it's part three of a 4-parter.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I mean, if you're coming into it, I don't think I had number 24, and I think I bought this when I bought this up in the Poconos. I was like, all right, like I'm just. Yeah. I mean, luckily there's an opening page that gives you a recap of everything that's happened, which was like, very helpful.
Yeah. Well, and I think I was just thinking about this where I saw this, and for a long time too, I was collecting obviously the back issues of the Baxter series, which were sometimes hard to come by. And there was a second Tamarant storyline where, you know, Blackfire had survived the confrontation she has with Corey in this annual. And, you know, there's this whole thing where Corey's brought back to Tamarin to face off, you know, because she's got to marry Karis. It goes on for like a good year and a half. Like, it starts – like, it's hinted at in issue one of the Baxter series, because, like, by then the Omega Men had, like, beaten the Citadel or whatever. And then right around Crisis is one of the Crisis crossovers, is her being brought there. And then she finally comes back it's almost about a year, I think, it takes that storyline to resolve itself. But there's like three different storylines going on together with the Titans, because there's the second Brother Blood storyline, and there's the whole Steve Dayton going nuts for the umpteenth time. And that's all three of those are happening, and it starts right around like issue like 13 of the series, and it ends with issue like – I think the Dayton one wraps up at like 34. I mean, it's a huge stretch of time, and it – meanders in places. It's good in places, it's not so good in places. And so that's what I always associate with the Starfire and space stuff. This is a little tighter of a storyline, but even then, like, I don't hate this storyline, but it is one of those where I just kind of like, I do kind of check out a little bit, where I'm like, you know, I want to get to the stuff that I really, you know, really like. Because if I'm within continuity, I go to issue 26, then I read the X-Men crossover, and then then there's like the Brotherhood of Evil storyline that comes out of that.
I loved all that
Terra and all that stuff, and so the stuff that comes after this to me is like my prime Titans stuff. But even then, I do really like this book. I like the fact that we have a classic, really Marvel-esque cover of a standoff and word balloons and we don't get that as much as we used to. So
yeah, I love the cover. I also love – I mean, this is obviously George Perez in his prime here, although you could argue that pretty much George Perez from 80s till he retired was George Perez in his prime.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, I love the lighting on the cover because all the light is emanating from X-Hal because she's glowing. And I love the hard shadows being thrown on Robin and Changeling and Cyborg. Like, that's really cool. I like that moment. Like, I mean, not that moment. I like that visual that he bothered to do it to really give a very strong light source to this cover. And it just gives it an extra sort of level of drama. And then, of course, there's that little banner that promises the free preview for Masters of the Universe, which we will get to in a moment. I will say the things that I loved about this comic is the stuff that I always loved about the Teen Titans is that a lot of it is the characterization that Wolfman was dropping in. I love the idea that Robin is like testy. Like, that's cool. I like all that stuff. I mean, at one point he sort of snaps at Cyborg because he's so worried about Starfire, which is he's letting his emotions, you know, get the best of him, something his mentor would not approve of. I like that. And the way Perez is able to, again, he creates these fully realized worlds. Just the detail he puts into stuff is unreal. But I also love that, like, when someone explodes, like when Changeling is facing off against this guard and he's trying to stall, and then out of nowhere you see Cyborg come and shoot one of his, like, extendor fists into the guy, and he goes, scrack, and he blows it. Like, it really looks like a violent explosion. In Justice League, again, which is my favorite comic, you would just kind of get somebody knocked out because it was more kid-friendly. But this has some real, like, heft and violence to it. And then on the same page, Changeling grabs the gun and shoves it in the guard's mouth. He doesn't pull the trigger, but, I mean, it's, again, it's much more edgier and violent than you would – that you kind of saw in early DC comics of the 80s.
Yeah, and credit to the inker and the colorist –
Oh, yeah, Romeo Tangel did a lot of great work for George Perez.
Yeah, and Perez, I mean, one of the only things I don't know, it's not even a criticism of Perez, but Perez is one of those pencilers who, like, if you've seen enough of his work, you can see where the inking has influence over the finished product. Because, like, I think Mike DiCarlo would ink him later on in this run, and I just really didn't like it.
Right.
Because Mike DiCarlo tends to – like, I like DiCarlo on Jim Aparo in the Batman stuff of the late 80s. But Tangal, like, really – he doesn't pull a Vince Coletta and erase all the backgrounds. And
erasing George Perez's backgrounds would be, like, a hate crime practically.
But also, like, you know, Carl Gafford's the colorist and Adrian Roy would be the colorist on a number of other issues. And they really do stretch the limits of what coloring was able to do back in the 80s because, you know, there's a lot of – you're right. Especially in this page, it's like page 8 here with Raven's having her freak out. You know, they let her do the – they color her. They use a lot of blacks and things like that, you know, you might not get in other comics. And they really do let the backgrounds there's not a lot of panels with a character with just a random color on the background. Like, you see that in a lot of Superman and Batman comics of this decade where, like, Batman would be talking and there's, like, is the wall orange now? Or, you know, like, and maybe it's just because I was reading some like Starlin Aparo Batman last night, but I'm looking at the backgrounds of this, and sometimes you have white backgrounds, but a lot of times, like, you know exactly where you are, and everybody's got that sort of distinct, you know, their distinct look. I do love the opening splash page, by the way.
Yeah, the of everybody fighting. And again, it's like one of the things I liked about the Omega Men, and I bought that series. I bought every issue of the Omega Men from stem to stern. And one of the things, again, the things I liked about, and looking back on this comic, it's like, wow, this is a code-approved comic. The Omega Men are pretty violent. I mean, Brute grabs this one guard and just twists his neck around, and you see, like, green blood spurt out. And I mean, I like the idea because it's like, this is a war. People get killed in what, you know, there really isn't, you don't knock people out in a war. You kill them. That's basically how you win these wars. And so I like how much the Omega Men are just willing to sort of tear into these characters. It's like, oh my God, it's pretty brutal. And I like said that Wolfman doesn't shy away from that because, again, this is the Teen Titans involving themselves in a war. I've always liked the Omega Men. This is them in their early costume. Like, they're more kind of superhero-y costumes. Callista and Primus look a little more like superheroes. And then, again, another little detail, stuff that I love that I think Perez threw in because he just – I don't know. I guess he was like a speed demon at how fast he could do this stuff. But, like, on page 11, right, and we've got Cyborg and Changeling and Robin, and they're on this warship. And there's this point where Cyborg is saying, I got to tell you, Robbie, I don't like this. I'm scared. I don't feel in control. And Robin says, I don't blame you, Vic. And you see him retying his collar for his cape. And just that little detail of like, your costume gets mussed when you're doing all the – just that extra effort to draw Robin doing that as opposed to just having his arms on his sides, which is a lot easier to draw. Perez took the time to do that. Those little bits of character are just really wonderful. And again, it gave the book, as crazy as all this is, it gives it that feeling of verisimilitude of like, these are people that have to do a lot of the things we all have to do when your shirt is unbuttoned or your shoelace is untied. It just that little you never saw Batman like ever kind of do stuff like that. Like his cowl was always perfect, but Robin has to like readjust himself. It gets this nice little detail.
Yeah, he was one of like a small handful of people who could draw the older Dick Grayson in the classic Robin costume and not make it look silly.
Yes.
That I think, and I know Mike Bailey's mentioned this a number of times, like one of the things that you came to realize through Perez and some of these artists was that it was like more than one piece. Like the green was this bodysuit underneath of it and the red part went over it. Like
right,
Marshall
like a separate tunic kind of thing.
Yeah. Marshall Rogers, Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, could really, and Dick Giordano could draw these really, really well. And I guess I would add Neil Adams to that, but you know, but then there were a lot of people who just didn't draw this costume very well, but yeah, you're right. Those little touches, or you know, the page previous to this, he's got wear and tear on Donna's costume, mm-hmm. but it's not like male gaze wear and tear. You know, it's there's a little bit of a rip of the halter and a little of a rip on the side, but it's not like, you know, if this were about 10 years later and Mike Deodato Jr. was, you'd have like three strips of fabric left. And so he was really, really good at drawing women in a way that was like sexy, but not like vulgar. If that makes sense. I mean,
because
Corey, Corey is definitely in I guess it's like Red Sonja in space costume. And there's definitely a lot of titillation there, but the way they always characterized her, it was never, the new 52 really did her wrong by making her like way more like porn star esque is almost the way they made her out to be. Whereas here there's a proportion to the way she's drawn. She has what Phil Jimenez has referred to as the 80s drag queen hair. and it's just it's very, but they, you know, he has her in these situations and it just it doesn't look like it doesn't look like exploitative. And then if you were to, you know, when she's captured for pretty much the entire issue, so you don't really see much of her fighting. But if you get into if you were to read on into the annual, it's like it's a vicious fight between the two of them,
right?
And it's like you forget like how strong she is as a like fighter, and it's really good. And even Raven, who I know that this title gets a lot of grief from a number of us on the way it just dragged out Raven's whole teenage angst part, but this is a good scene with her getting so overwhelmed by everything in the field, and then her father kind of like creeping in a little bit, and that I think it was a good way to do that, because it only took about a page and a half at the most, and then she kind of recovered and moved on. And as you got later and later into the run, she got weaker and weaker and weaker until that really good start of the Baxter series run.
I remember that. Yeah. Now you said you read the annual. So do you remember? Is there a turn? Because I have not read it. But at the end of the story, where Robin basically says, "All right, Blackfire, you've killed the ruler. So you've taken over by force. You get what you want. So let us leave." I was like, "What? What? Like that, does Robin, is that a double blind? Is Robin going to pull a double cross in the annual? Because that doesn't, that seems like a very, looks slightly unheroic thing to do, because she just assumed command by murdering the previous ruler. It's not exactly like a democratic rule or anything.
I think it's, he's trying to protect Corey.
Right.
And it might be a little bit, but it never really comes to fruition because, you know, she breaks free from him and says, I'll stop you even if I have to kill you. And then the first page is a splash of just her face screaming essentially the same thing. And page 2 and 3 of the annual are a double page spread of her flying up and hitting her right in the stomach with a starbolt.
Hmm.
And the fight begins. And then the entire thing is that they basically are now going to have to fight their way out of here. And it eventually comes to, like, the Scion, who is one of the Scions who's kind of trying to pull the strings behind everything, having Corey and her sister fight it out in, like, on Tamaran, just between the two of them, like Mortal Kombat style. And the Omega Men and the Titans launch an attack on, like, the Citadel, you know, moon or worlds or whatever. And so it's kind of very there's almost a Return of the Jedi aspect to it, where you have, like, you know, the fight between the two family members going on, and then just kind of the big brawl going on up in space and everything. And it ends with – we also get this whole origin of the Vegan system and Exile and – you know, like, kind of the background on some of that. But I'm trying to remember how the fight ends, with basically Corey and her sister going over a waterfall.
Hmm.
And it looks like her sister is dead. But in true comic book fashion, you never see a body.
Well, there you go.
You just see Corey, like, clinging to a rock. And then they show up at the end and Raven saves her. And she realizes, oh, her brother's alive. But unfortunately, because of the way that the politics of the system worked, Corey has to return to Earth because her parents are like, no, you can't stay here. It's part of the agreement or whatever. Because her parents are just awful in general. I mean, this whole storyline of how they had to compromise by essentially kind of selling her into slavery, or like keeping her off planet because of whatever. It's the only way to keep the peace or something. It's just really – you get the conflict in it, but it's a really, really crappy thing to do.
I mentioned that this comic came out on August 12th, and then I looked up the release date of the annual, which was August 19th. So just 1 week later, you had the conclusion, which as a comic book fan, what a treat that had to be, because you were basically – and I never had that comic, the annual, and so it must not have made it up to the Poconos at the time, because I probably would have bought it if I had seen it available. But then that also makes me wonder – how did George Perez get it done? Because the annual is drawn by George Perez. So not only did he do every issue of New Teen Titans every month, he also drew like a 48-page annual. Like, my God, when did the man sleep?
Well, that's what's crazy, because he does this. This is the first of three annuals that finish major storylines. And with the next annual, which is the one that introduces the Vigilante.
Oh, I love that comic. I have that one. That's great.
Issue 35 and 36, which are the ones that after that were actually done with fill-in artists, like Keith Pollard or Rich Buckler or somebody filled in on the art because of the fact that he had to, you know, draw these issues. And he kind of, as you get into the post-Judas Contract stuff, he falls off because he falls off of doing this book on the regular, because not only is he also penciling the Baxter series for a little while, he crisis starts up. So, you know, you do see how, like, you know, eventually he does hand over the art chores and leaves the book. But yeah, you're right. I'm like, this is crazy. And I don't know how distribution worked for the annuals, because I don't know if it was – whereas in a comic store now, you'd get the annual because they were ordering the title. But I don't know if, like, you know, your local stationery store or drugstore would always have the annual.
Yeah.
You know?
I said I would have gotten it if I had seen it for sale, because I would have been interested in the story enough to want to conclude it, but I never had it. So, yeah, it must have just never appeared. So I was like, okay. But, yeah, I mean, altogether, it's a fine issue. It's not certainly one of my favorite New Titans, but it's a Mountain comic, and I still remember buying it off the stands and reading it. And, again, it was George Perez and Marv Wolfman doing New Teen Titans, so it's exciting. And so it's a fun book. It's got just action up the wazoo. You've got the Omega Men, who, again, I become a fan of, despite all the brickbats I've taken for that. I still love the Omega Men. So I did mention that this does come with a free preview for the Masters of the Universe. Now, a lot of comics came with that. It was inserted into a lot of DC comics that month. We're not going to cover it extensively. It's been talked about here on the network. But, I mean, it is the Masters of the Universe story. It's Fate is the Killer. It's by my pal Paul Kupperberg and Kurt Swan and Dave Hunt. So, I mean, it's a fun little preview because it inserts Superman into it because, of course, as we know, he was the ambassador for DC Comics where he had to meet everybody, whether it was, you know, Santa Claus or the Quick Bunny. I mean, always had to insert him in this thing. Overall, just what are your impressions of the Masters of the Universe preview special?
Yeah, I'd laugh at the Superman thing, but Marvel did that with Spider-Man.
That's right.
They did that with Spider-Man, and I think in the Transformers book at this time.
That's right.
'84. And then with NFL Super Pro later on. So,
oh, God.
So this was what's funny is that, like, I don't think this exactly predates. I'd have to look up the date of the premiere of the TV cartoon. And I'm really too lazy to do that right now. I want to say that because usually these are written and drawn a few months in advance, this might have beaten the Filmation cartoon by a little bit, or at least its production would have been. Because this is – there's this and I'm going off the top of my head, but, you know, later on Marvel would do a He-Man and the Masters of the Universe comic through the Star Comics line that was much which was much more like the cartoon.
By the way, the show debuted September 5th, 1983. So this beats it by a year.
So this is around the time where, like, it's not as kiddie. It's almost very you see this is like sword and sorcery aspect to this, which, I mean, you know, it's He-Man of the Masters of the Universe, but the Filmation cartoon is very genteel in a sense because it's just the way Filmation kind of worked.
You learn the lesson at the end.
Yeah, yeah. This is a lot more like Swan and Dave Hunt draw a few of these panels almost like it's like a Classics Illustrated of Ivanhoe or something from the 50s or 60s. It's or Prince Valiant. Like, it really is a throwback to like older medieval time type of setting for the comics. And then it's and even the way some of the characters are drawn, it feels very older school action adventure. And some of the mini comics I remember that were in some of the Master of the Universe stuff, and I remember specifically the Burger King cups were way more sophisticated than the cartoon, at least to a little kid. Like, this had a little bit of Conan to it. It was just like – it was just enough without going into that harder edged, you know, really ultra violent Frank Frazetta Conan stuff. You know, it's – I found this kind of fun. I'm you know, my experience with He-Man and the Masters Universe goes through like the 80s and then when I stopped collecting the toys because I started reading and collecting G.I. Joe. So beyond that and beyond just kind of watching like the documentaries about it and having the nostalgia for it, I'm not like a super fan or anything like that, so I'm not an expert. But it was just kind of fun to see this because I do remember that there's like a difference between the way they were originally presenting the mythology, the characters in comics and stuff when the line first came out and what it would be on TV about a year later.
What's interesting, too, is that basically all the DC free previews that they would do in that other run where it was for like All-Star Squadron and New Teen Titans, those were previewing ongoing comic series.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not doing that. DC's not preparing a Masters of the Universe ongoing series. So
I think they had a mini at one point, though.
They had the mini. I guess they did have the mini, and they did the full crossover in DC Comics Presents. But, I mean, it's like they're getting a lot of push, you know? I mean, and if you actually go and you watch the Toys That Made Us episode on Netflix about the Masters of the Universe, they talk about how they roped comic books into it as a marketing thing because toy retailers were very skeptical about – well, nobody knows who these characters are. You know, like, why would I buy a toy line, a bunch of characters nobody's heard of? He's like, well, we're going to have a comic book. Ooh, and then they made the deal. Like, they literally made the pitch before they even had a deal to make the comic book. They were like, how about a comic book? And the toy retailers were like, that sounds good. And then they were like, I guess we got to go somehow get a comic book made.
I don't know if you've ever if you've ever worked for a company that where the CEO will do that, or somebody in like sales will do that. I worked in marketing for a time, and I was in not those meetings, but I was like, you know, the day later when they were like, yeah, they kind of promised this, and we were all like, what? And that's what I felt watching that episode. I was like, oh, I've been there before. Because they were just kind of like, yeah, there's going to be a comic book. And you, like, everybody in the company's like, I guess there's a comic book.
It's a good thing they were able to strike a deal. So, and then there was one house ad that I wanted to cover from this comic. And it is the DC is on the move ad, which everybody remembers from this time. It's from 1982. And it's interesting is that DC is promoting kind of their I don't want to say off-brand series, but certainly not their major their major IP brand series. And so it says DC is on the move, and it's got Camelot 3000, Arion, Lord of Atlantis, Supergirl, and Blackhawk. And so there's a couple of things I think about when I look at this ad. First of all, it's very nicely composed. Like, I just think it's just a handsome-looking ad. Mm-hmm. But it is probably the only ad support Blackhawk ever got, this Mark Evanier run of Blackhawk. I literally don't think I saw an ad for the Blackhawk comic ever. And those were comments that Mark Evanier would make himself in columns in the back of Crossfire, where he would say, DC Comics, the company that was known to say, oh, do we publish Blackhawk? And then he said, you've got Supergirl and Arion, Lord of Atlantis, both series written by Paul Kupperberg. So between that and the Masters of the Universe preview, he's kind of all over this comic.
I know.
He must have. I'll have to ask him. He must have been thrilled with this ad because, I mean, two of his series are getting promoted alongside Camelot 3000, which was one of their kind of big, you know, Baxter titles, like prestige titles, was that series too. So I always like this ad just because it's not Superman, it's not Batman, it's not Justice League, it's Blackhawk, Supergirl. It's kind of like they're trying new things, and I think it's a nice ad.
Yeah, it is. It is. Looking at their coming attractions thing, and it's really this mix of stuff that had been kind of languishing since the 70s, and then stuff that would, you know, that would be a little bit more, you know, that would be a little more forward for the 80s, because they're still publishing like the House of Mystery,
Night Force, Captain Carrot's Amazing Zoo Crew,
Weird War Tales and stuff. Not that these are bad comics, but it's just like, you know, I think about a year or two later, some of these would be
gone. Yep,
would be gone.
Yeah, and they said I'm looking through some of these, and I'm like, oh, these are other Mountain comics I had, like Night Force number 4. I remember buying that one. So yeah, so it was very. I loved all those things. Very handy to know what was on sale. So anyway, that is New Teen Titans number 25. Like I said, it's not one of my all time favorite Mountain comics, but I say it's the New Teen Titans. I still love it, and I certainly enjoyed it, and it was worth the 60 cents I spent for it in August of 1982. As I sat on the porch and read it. So Tom, thank you so much for finally coming on to Mountain Comics. It was great to finally have you on the show.
Yeah, and I will add that if you're interested in reading this, I'm sure it's on – I'm 100% sure it's on Comixology. But they've been collecting – they've collected the entire Wolfman Perez – original Wolfman Perez run in trade and omnibuses and everything. And because they're to the point where like they're reprinting the Baxter stuff that Eduardo Barreto drew. That's how deep they're gone so far. Yeah. This was in – because I'm flipping through the trade here. This was in volume 4. Of the New Teen Titans, which reprints issues 21 through 27, plus that annual. So you get the first Brother Blood appearance all the way up to the end of the Runaway storyline. It's a really, really good trade. I'm sure that InStock Trades has it for a decent price.
I'm sure they do. So. Yeah. Oh, yeah. The Wolfman Perez Teen Titans was one of the early – everything being reprinted all the time. DC knew what they had on their hands. So why don't you tell people where they can find you on the internet?
Sure. I am mostly over at the Two True Freaks Network with two podcasts, three if you count the one that I finished. So the one that I finished was called In Country. It was about the NOM, the Marvel Comics series from the 80s and 90s. I also have Required Reading with Tom and Stella. That's where Stella and I take a look at a work of literature every month and do a discussion of that. And then I have Pop Culture Affidavit. That's my main podcast. It is really a hodgepodge show, everything random in the world of popular culture. So it's comics, books, TVs, TV movies, you know, music and everything. You can find that at popcultureaffidavit.com. And lately I've been covering comics. Like I did the Return of Donna Troy for the JL May crossover. This year I did the Reynis Helgemeier novel Smile, and then in July of 2020, which is a few weeks after coming up a few weeks after we are recording this, I will be covering the Brian K. Vaughan series Paper Girls with Stella. So doing some good comics lately. So you can find that at popcultureaffidavit.com, and you can find me on Twitter at popaff. That's P-O-P-A-F-F.
All right, very cool. Well, thanks everybody for listening. Tom and I are going to grab some yoo-hoos and sit on the porch and look out as the sun goes down and talk about comics again. Thanks everybody for listening, and we will see you next month. Bye. You were working as a waitress in a